Wait a second, okay? One. The Mat-Su Borough is a step closer to authorizing the state's first forest management agreement with a private timber company. The Assembly Tuesday night authorized Charles Nash and Associates of Big Lake to go ahead with an agreement to prepare a multi-use management plan for 35,000 acres of land in the center of the Matanuska Valley. The plan will focus on timber development, but will also include recreational access and public use cabins. The Assembly went ahead over objections from Area Representative Doyle Holmes and Mayor Barbara Locker, who argued for a postponement, saying people were unable to give testimony due to the winter storm.
Why not wait 2 weeks when we have been requested by people who are adamantly opposed to a forester doing the planning for multi-use property rather than the public entity doing that planning?
Assemblyman Robert Wells says he supports the decision to move forward because there's to be no timber harvest under the first decision, and the public will continue to have ample time for input over the next 18 months. 2 years ago, the Oregon-based company Menasha Corporation tried to craft a management agreement, but public opposition discouraged the company, forcing it to abandon its agreement after 2 weeks. At the time, the company said it withdrew because the agreement wasn't economically feasible. Assemblyman Scott Sterling has served notice of reconsideration, meaning he can prompt another vote at the next assembly meeting. With no further setbacks, Nash and Associates would spend the next 18 months developing the plan and gathering public comment. The Borough Assembly will then make a final decision on the proposal. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Three, two, one. In 1968, old-time Alaska hippie John Neal heard about some land available for trade and manufacturing homesteading located below the Ruth Glacier, 30 miles from the summit of Mount McKinley. He and his brother-in-law scraped up enough money for a plane trip from Anchorage to what is now called Pirate Lake.
It all began with getting hold of an old-time pilot by the name of Paul Lavalette. And he flew us in and arrived on Pirate Lake over here about noon. And it was about 20, 25 below with a light wind.
Lavalette kindly stayed with the plane to keep it warm, making sure when it was time to leave, the group could do so. Neal says it took a lot of hustle to keep warm and get the job done.
We just started off with a compass and a 100-foot tape measure and located our corners, which were blazed spruce trees. And number one corner, the way we done it was took a bow saw, cut the top of a small spruce off, and nailed a can lid to the top of the post and put our filing papers inside the jar and screwed it down on the post. And that paper was there for 20 years and finally disintegrated inside the jar.
Neal remembers the wind blowing cold that day. Took 3 hours to measure the corners. He was grateful to Lavalette for staying around.
Yeah, by the time we got through with our taping off the area, we were taping off 80 acres with a 100-foot tape measure, it took a little while. And I remember I was sure glad to get back into that plane and to get out of here.
Neal returned to Anchorage where his brother-in-law and partner filed the papers with BLM. Neal was the first homesteader in the Tokositna area. Between 1968 and 1970, he built his first cabin. Since then, he's run a small trap line, leased the property at times to outfitters, and continually hosts area tourists. Neal teaches his children at home, has built a new lodge, a few more cabins, and is now training his son to one day take up the guide business. Trade, manufacturing, and homesteading ended in Alaska in 1968. Next time we'll speak with Neal about some of the wild times he's had during his nearly 30 years of homesteading. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Three, two, one. In the last few years, making a living from the Yukon River has become more difficult. Fishers are bound by high transportation costs, uncertain fish runs, and a growing world supply of farmed and hatchery fish. This summer, buyers paid less than 20 cents a pound for Yukon summer chums, and the season was cut short by competing fish. Dan Albrecht, director of YRDFA, the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, says not long ago, Yukon and Kuskokwim chums were a main supply for the early summer salmon market.
Hatchery production has increased in Southeast and in Prince William Sound to some extent, and that's starting to hit the market these last few years earlier than it used to and in larger volumes. And since our fish basically cannot compete with the production from those hatcheries.
Yukon fishers have also lost part of the market for chum roe, and Southeast Aquaculture Associations have been competing with the Yukon in supplying high-grade Ikura roe to Japan. Albrecht says the state set up an unfair subsidy by financing hatcheries, giving them an advantage over Yukon fisheries. Currently, each hatchery region sets its own production goals, and Yukon fishers say that's led to overproduction, which is pushing them out of the market. Albrecht says members of his association want the state to work towards setting statewide production goals for hatcheries.
We can't control farm salmon production. We can't control the Japanese and them going into Russia or getting fish from Chile or Norway. But we can control what goes on in our own state. And so, you know, we're looking at action by the Fish and Game Department and the governor's office on the things they can actually affect. And the hatchery programs is one of those programs.
Albrecht is advocating a 5-year plan to scale back hatchery production, signaling the latest wrinkle in the ongoing debate over managing the state's fisheries. Arguments have usually centered on fish ownership, like in the False Pass debate, where Yukon fishers blame Area M operators for taking chums destined for the rivers. Now, YERDFA members are pointing at a whole segment of the fishery. UAA economics professor Gunnar Knapp says that can lead to treacherous waters.
It's a tricky issue who's really getting subsidized in commercial fishing, if anyone. There are all other costs that are involved in managing wild fisheries as well. And so to really talk about sort of where the subsidies are and where they're biggest, you'd have to look at those costs too and what the fisheries are returning to the state.
Knapp says while restricting fish production may raise prices in the short run, there's no guarantee that other producers won't fill the void, returning prices to a low level, leaving Alaska with a smaller share of the world market. Add to that the difficulty in establishing who exactly would have to give up the fish.
I think that might be a nightmare in how you design that, in how you figure out, who exactly is supposed to catch fewer fish, because the fish may not cooperate, more may show up than you expected, or less may show up.
Knapp says while he sympathizes with the plight of Western Alaska fishermen, there are no easy answers, and he doubts that production controls would work for long. Hatchery managers don't much like the idea either. Bruce Bakken, operations manager for the Northern Southeast Aquaculture Association, says his hatcheries produce about 30% of the state's chum salmon. He argues the way to increase income is to get more people to eat more fish.
As lower-priced fish are available and they're there and people are pushing them, that, you know, more and more usages are found for those fish. And then they get used to using salmon, and then the next year, you know, they're ready as buyers.
Bakken reminds observers that the last couple years have seen record runs for chums, but those probably won't continue. The El Nino current is good for fish populations, he says, and that current has subsided, so while Western Alaska fishers are having a tough time, their prospects may soon improve. The YERDFA is hosting its annual meeting in Minto later this month, where it will address the issue of changing markets, as well as the continuing issue of subsistence fall chum management. Meanwhile, Fish and Game Commissioner Frank Rue is putting together a committee to examine the hatchery question and ways to improve salmon quality. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
United Airlines isn't just pulling out of Fairbanks this spring. It'll move out of Little Rock, Arkansas, and New Haven, Connecticut, too. An airline spokesman said revenues just aren't covering costs. Not that United is profitable everywhere it flies, but in these three cities, he said it's time to cut losses. United lost $2.6 million on its Fairbanks run in 1995 alone, almost $14 million since 1990. Just as United folds its tent, another carrier is moving in. An indication, says Fairbanks Airport Manager Doyle Ruff, United's problem isn't location. Fairbanks may not be a booming market, but it is a predictable one.
We're not a layover airport. We're not a We're not a hub. We're like SeaTac, for example, where a lot of people are flying in here from a lot of different directions and going, laying over and going on. You're either coming to Fairbanks or you're not, notwithstanding those passengers who are going on to some of our outlying communities.
Ruff notes that fluctuations in air carrier service aren't all that unusual nationwide. Change and uncertainty have dogged airlines since 1978. Prior to that, Ruff says the industry was fairly stable, with a few well-known carriers.
The names that we all remember through those 50s and 60s and 70s. With deregulation, with the government getting out of the business of setting their particular fee structures and their route structures and so forth, a lot of new carriers jumped in, and things became very competitive and very volatile.
Reno Air is one of the new ones, in the business less than 4 years. It found Anchorage receptive last spring and now sees Fairbanks as another natural link to its service up and down the West Coast and flights as far east as Chicago. Reno Air spokeswoman Annie Turner says the airline is keeping things simple.
We fly one type of aircraft. We fly MD-80 jets, which seat 20 in first class and 120 in coach. So in flying the same type of aircraft, you're able to keep your costs down as far as maintenance, training, employees, that type of thing.
What Turner calls unique snacks will also keep costs down. And although she says Reno's flights will have their amenities, Reno is emphasizing their low fares. Longtime air operator Art Warbelow has been watching the local market for years. He says airline strategies try to match the way people fly. Some take the cheapest seats, some want convenience or fly to collect frequent flyer miles, and some put safety first.
You have to identify how many people are in each of those segments and match a strategy up that will keep you in business, depending on how you see those segments.
Reno will come into the Fairbanks market with rock-bottom prices, but Warbelow says if it comes to a fare war, although passengers might like it, the airlines will undoubtedly take a beating.
So it just becomes a question of how long you can lose money, who's got the deepest pockets.
In the era of the bottom line, even as corporations cut operations to the bone, Warbelow says there will always be a Reno Air coming in to test a new vision.
As they say in the industry, there's some people that just have jet fuel running in their veins, and that's what they want to do. At the level of the commuters in Alaska here, there's a lot of people who are in the business, not necessarily to make dollars, but because they love the business. And to some extent, I think that's true of some of the airlines, that it's a attractive, romantic business.
Still, in a bottom-line business, love doesn't always pay the bills. United moves out of Fairbanks April 6th, just as Reno Air moves in. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
The 13th running of the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race starts Saturday in Fairbanks. 21 mushers, including 8 rookies, will leave the starting line on their way to Whitehorse to buy for $100,000 in prize money and a donated belt buckle worth an estimated $60,000. This year's lineup of mushers is the smallest in the history of the race, but new management has helped put the race on more solid financial footing. Quest officials say they're confident that the prize money will be there for the first 10 mushers to cross the finish line. Big names in this race include previous winners Frank Turner and John Schandelmeyer and 1983 Iditarod champion Rick Mackey. In spite of the lack of snow, race manager Barry Emmett says the trail is in fairly good shape, but for 1996, what has been called the toughest sled dog race in the world may more realistically turn out to be the roughest. In Fairbanks, I'm Roger Leff.
Coming off the race last year, the Yukon Quest was some $30,000 in debt. But through hard work and professional management, the race has doubled its purse to $100,000, and officials say they'll be able to pay their bills. Those financial troubles, combined with poor snow cover, have led to the fewest drivers in race history. With little snow for cushioning, the first 200 miles of trail may hold some sudden surprises. And while only 21 drivers are entered, each one will have some sort of story to tell. For Canadian psychologist Bill Stewart, the latest chapter was written last night when he failed to notice his best lead dog parked too close to a jealous teammate.
Unfortunately, we had a dogfight last night, and our main leader looks like he's going to be out. So without him, I haven't got a clue what we can do. Right now, I guess we'll just try and finish and, you know, have some fun along the way.
Stewart finished last year in seventh place to win Rookie of the Year, but his story illustrates just one of the difficulties drivers face in running a dog team. Fellow Canadian Frank Turner, the only man to run every Quest so far, has returned in an attempt to repeat last year's performance. Turner came from behind in the last 100 miles to win the race, and he gives much of the credit to his participation the year before.
Running with Levon Barbie 2 years ago really was a great education for me, just in the way he managed his team and just focused on the dogs in front of him and never really got knocked out of focus by worrying about what somebody else is doing. If you worry about your take care of your own self, you're in your own team, then that's about the best you're going to do. So, and then you see how it comes out at the end.
Turner says he has pretty much the same dog team as he ran last year, and while he's not exceptionally competitive, race watchers can expect him to be close to the front. Turner's joined on the trail this year by 1992 champion John Schandelmeyer. The Paxson musher spent last year running races outside, and he says this year he'll work on proving a small kennel can still grow strong dogs that can run 1,000 miles.
I'd like to get 14 dogs to Whitehorse and right up in the top end, you know, without, I mean, I can get 14 dogs to Whitehorse if I go slow. I want to get 14 dogs to Whitehorse fast. I mean, to me, that'd be a terrific accomplishment if I could do that. And that's kind of what this is about.
Schandelmeyer's hoping for a top three finish. He has a good shot at that and perhaps winning, though he'll have to fight off a challenge from Iditarod champion Rick Mackey, who says after running the last great race 18 times, he's ready for a change. Mackey will get that change soon. The race starts tomorrow from the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Former race manager Frank Ganley, who's run the Quest 3 times, figures about 5% of the entrants run to win or place. Most drivers, he says, enter as a personal challenge to test themselves and their dogs.
You know, it takes a lot of determination, and I think the race itself is a test of a lot of things to people. Not only their endurance and stamina and dog training abilities, but their just putting a race like this together for yourself really tests your organizational abilities. It really takes an unbelievable effort to go out and do it.
Ganley says that effort takes more than raw ambition or grit. It's details, buying or sewing, repairing and keeping track of 1,000 booties, repairing a sled on the run, caring for the needs of 12 dogs, and doing it all efficiently.
You watch the top 10 people in races like this, and that's what always impresses me most about some of these guys like Jeff King and Vern Halter, and they've got it together. They don't waste steps. You know, when they're in checkpoints, they're done pretty efficiently, and it definitely makes a big difference. But even, you know, all the way down through the field, those organizational skills really do help out.
And it's a physically trying trail that takes stamina, the ability to handle the cold, and to be smart in all sorts of conditions. Longtime race manager Debbie Ganley has watched the mushers closely since the first Quest was run 12 years ago. In her opinion, they're driven to do what they do.
Any of them you talk to, why do you do this? It's almost like something that's in their blood. They have to do it. They're like marathoners. They have to do it because it's there. It's a challenge, and it's not an option to them. Sooner or later, they're going to have to do it. They're all driven.
She says it's not even a matter of how the musher finishes, whether the race is won or lost.
I think it's the challenge of the land and being out there, and there's a lot of them that'll tell you there's nothing like being out there on a moonlit night, you and 12 dogs, and knowing that you're entirely dependent upon each other and that you have the stamina and the capacity to do that. And that's what they all have in common.
For some, it's the country and the remarkable opportunity to experience it fully. And, says Frank Ganley, it's also an ultimate experience.
There are people that, like the Iditarod, people that live for it. I mean, that's all they, you know, they just live throughout the summer to run the Yukon Quest in the wintertime, or to drive dogs in the wintertime. And, you know, it becomes a way of life after a while. And I think that anybody that's in mid-distance or long-distance racing is going to I mean, you just naturally aspire to run the Yukon Quest or eventually run the Iditarod.
In short, running the Yukon Quest International is not the kind of thing you do on a whim or because your friends are out there. You have to want to be there. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. Some drivers will look first at build and conformity, how the animal looks, its gait or personality. Frank Ganley, who's run the Yukon Quest 3 times, says the bottom line can be pretty simple.
You know, a lot of people will tell you they don't care how they look or act, as long as the, as long as their tug line stays tight, they don't, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't know, you know, you got to have speed, and you got to have, in long distance racing, you got to have feet.
A dog's got to have good feet, and not all feet are alike.
Well, some dogs have got real tough feet that don't, they don't, I mean, you don't have to booty them that much. They can run all day on them, and they'll never get sore. Mm-hmm. Some will get, they'll get snowballs, and they'll start to wear pads or wear in between the soft tissue in between toes. You look at some dogs' feet, and they're real long-toed, and they really spread out when they put them on the ground. And you look at some that are just as tight as can be when they're, even when they're standing with all their weight on them.
Breeders also try to produce good appetites in their pups because racing dogs need to chow down at feeding time to stay strong and keep running. And in distance racers, Ganley says you have to breed for a good, thick coat.
There's a lot of hound bred into dogs, a lot of sprint dogs anymore, and some of them just aren't, they don't have the hair coat that you want in long distance racing because they're laying out there at 30 or 40 below. They need that good, dense undercoat.
The dogs that are winning races these days, even in long-distance runs, are fairly small, averaging 45 to 55 pounds, with females at the lower end of that range. And though mushers might start training pups at 5 or 6 months, as any non-mushing dog owner knows, it takes time for a dog to mature. For running 1,000 miles, Frank Ganley feels even two-year-olds are marginal.
3 years old or older, 3 years to, you know, seven, eight. A lot of long-distance dogs can go a lot longer than that. There have been, you know, good leaders and team dogs that have gone, you know, 10, 11 years. I think Paley Bill Cotter's leader was 10 or 11 years old when he won the Quest in 87. So they can go quite a while, but that those first couple of years, it takes them that long to, you know, get the experience and the maturity and settle down a little bit. Yeah.
While the dogs behind the leader may need to keep that tug line tight, lead dogs are special, and they don't come along in every litter. Some drivers say a good leader has some of the same attributes human leaders have, but Frank Ganley looks for just two qualities in his leader.
They've got to be willing to please you. And if you've got that, you know, you work on the rest of it. Mentally, they've got to be super tough to stay up front all the time like that. There's a lot of them that can run back in the team that just can't do it up front because they don't have the mental toughness it takes to stay out in front, you know.
When it comes to the rest of the pack, Ganley says as long as they love to run, he'll run along with them. From Fairbanks, with a look at the dogs on the Yukon Quest, I'm Susan McInnes. The Yukon Quest was conceived in a bar and born on the trail. If the metaphor holds, its gestation was carried out in successively larger meeting rooms. The first organizational meeting drew just 7 people, but when 150 showed up, the founders knew they had a race on their hands. Quest co-founder Roger Williams remembers the initial idea, that one born over a beer, was to extend the Bullseye to Angel Creek race, continuing its trail from Fairbanks to Chena Hot Springs.
And somebody said, well, if we can get to the Hot Springs, then we can just jump across and go to the Steese Highway, and from there we can go up to the Central, and if we get to Central, we can go up to Circle, and if we're in Circle, we're on the Yukon River, and we can go to Dawson, and then finally the juices started flowing, and I'm thinking, well, this is roughly the route that the pioneers took when they came into the interior of Alaska, the people that settled the place before there was ever a highway or anything.
In the Gold Rush days, the Stampeders were miners, trappers, explorers, missionaries, and tradesmen. They sailed from Seattle to Skagway and, as many well-known photographs attest, hauled themselves up and over the Chilkoot Pass. They ended up in a place called White Horse Rapids.
And at this point, they would, most of them would build rafts. And they'd put all their belongings on the rafts and they'd hit the Yukon River. and float the Yukon River all the way to Dawson. And then from Dawson, there was a very big community in Dawson. The way the gold seekers, the way it happened, they first found gold in the Yukon, and then they found gold in Alaska, and then they found more gold in the Yukon, so people were just using this trail, this Yukon River, as a trail, and going back and forth between the border, and there was no border crossings, no guards or anything. Everybody was, in those days, they were northerners, you know.
As the drivers and dogs race between Fairbanks and Whitehorse this year, they'll follow ghosts of the Gold Rush pioneers. They'll cover 1,000 miles, cross 3 major summits, and mush about 300 miles on the frozen highway of the north, the Yukon River.
The idea of having the Yukon Quest Trail run in the same approximate area that Stampeders was awfully appealing to a lot of people, mm-hmm. such as myself, that really aren't into the dog scene.
In November 1983, Williams and Leroy Shank co-founded the Yukon Quest International. The first race took place in February 1984 with 26 teams competing and a total purse of $50,000. I'm Susan McGinnis. The first race took place in February 1984 with 26 teams competing and a total purse of $50,000. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. It's the kind of thing kids bring home from daycare or school, and their parents carry home from work. It is strep throat, and it's been making the rounds in Fairbanks for the past week or so. The symptoms include a fever between 100 and 101 degrees, swollen neck glands, sore throat, and enlarged tonsils. Strep is highly contagious, but it is also easily diagnosed, and it is treatable. There's been some confusion in Fairbanks about whether strep is caused by a virus or a bacteria. Dr. Barbara Creighton with the Interior Neighborhood Health Clinic says the difference is an important one.
For most viruses, there's no treatment for. They just have to run their course. However, with bacteria, and strep is one of those bacteria, it's actually called strep group A, but bacteria can be treated with antibiotics.
Creighton says an inexpensive treatment with penicillin will often do the job. There are some concerns that untreated strep throat can lead to more serious diseases, like rheumatic fever or scarlet fever. Either one can damage the valves of the heart. Dr. Creighton says these concerns are real, but it is more rare these days because of early treatment.
It's there, but you just don't see it as much anymore.
Dr. Creighton says strep is airborne, spread by droplets, so sneezes, coughs, kissing, handshakes, and shared eating utensils can all carry the bacteria from person to person. People can keep from passing strep on to others by getting some treatment, and then covering coughs and sneezes, avoiding close contact with people, and keeping their hands clean. For those who are not feeling well but don't know whether their symptoms are the symptoms for strep throat, a physician or other health practitioner can do a quick throat culture and let them know within minutes. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. Since 1981, budgets at the state's Water Management Division have fallen 75%. There were once 39 people working in the division. After another round of cuts this year, only 7 will remain. Water Resources Chief Gary Prokosh says the division's had an 18-month backlog and can no longer fulfill its mission, so it's seeking changes in its mandate.
Alaska's water law is the best in the West. But we can't afford the best in the West right now. We need to make changes. Water rights in Idaho on the Snake River weren't important 150 years ago. They are very important now, and anybody who has water rights with a priority date of less than 1850 doesn't get water. We want to avoid that in Alaska, of course. We need to take that opportunity now and not wait 40 years when there's a problem.
Although not usually a problem in Alaska, Prokosh says as cities develop, individual aquifers may run dry. Water rights dictate who will get what water and in what order. For instance, a homeowner with established rights can assert them against others to ensure new projects don't diminish existing uses. Prokosh says such rights have far-reaching importance.
It should be of great interest to anybody that has water rights anybody that uses water for their home or for their business, anybody that is interested in in-stream flows for fish, wildlife, recreation.
DNR has several proposals for developing new management schemes, including turning the process over to the courts. Officials want public comment to draft a plan that will save money while protecting existing and future rights. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The law is not a perfect tool. Even so, it only narrowly defines sexual harassment as one of two types. According to educator Fran Sepler, there's a quid pro quo harassment. Have sex with me and I'll promote you. Don't and I'll punish you.
But more profoundly, hostile environment sexual harassment, which means that serious, pervasive, continuous, negative, sexually oriented or gender-based behavior is so pervasive in your work environment or your educational environment that it affects the fundamental terms of your employment or education.
Sepler says beyond these is a range of social or personal harassments, both more pervasive and harder to pin down. From teasing and catcalls to manipulations and threats, it's all part of growing up in America. Students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks run into these harassments on campus. Sophomore Chandra Stone says peer harassment is pretty common.
Several times it's happened to myself or my friends, you know, just people shouting things out of cars or out of windows, and it's just, I don't know what people feel they have the right to do that or even what, you know, makes them have the urge to say that to somebody.
Especially among the students, but I've seen it on this campus in more sophisticated levels too, and I've witnessed it between faculty and students.
Judy Toppins is also a sophomore at UAF.
I don't know if I would say that it's one way is any worse than the other. Whether someone's being manipulated or whether they're being catcalled, it's all harassment and no one should have to deal with it.
Like Stone and Toppins, Laura Kim Alexander sees peer harassment as a kind of residual adolescence.
I don't know how to phrase this and have it be nice, but a lot of the men here are not men, you know. They're pretty much boys, and they really don't understand that certain things that they say are not cute.
Alexander, who admittedly has strong verbal skills and self-confidence, says she favors a direct approach. If it's obnoxious, let them know then and there.
I'm just another person just like you, and if I was to say something like that to you, your eyes would probably pop out of your head, you know? That's wrong. You can't do that.
These women agree that the best thing to do when faced with harassment is to deal with it. Defend yourself. Talk back. Talk to someone who can intercede or can help in some way. But they also believe when there's an imbalance of power, especially between boss and worker or professor and student, solutions feel less certain. Chandra Stone.
Even if you try to, you know, get out of the situation, where are you going to go? And who's going to believe you if you tell somebody, because you're just the little peon at the bottom and they're this big guy at the top or big woman at the top, and, you know, you feel like you have no say in the matter.
Judy Toppins said she would still tell a friend to report or to seek help.
Talk to someone about it. It's hard to say. It depends. It completely depends on the situation and who the people are and what kind of person you are and whether you can, you know, confront this person.
Educator Fran Sepler says the kinds of harassments these women are talking about won't disappear anytime soon, and figuring out how to cope with them is an education in itself. For those who harass their peers, UAF student Eric Gervin says this is also what college is all about.
A lot of the education here is in interpersonal relations that exist very much outside of the classroom, and that hopefully by the time somebody graduates from college, they've learned some of what's really socially acceptable and some of what's not.
Learning what's called sexual respect these days isn't easy, and it's not in any college curricula, but it's a subject students are learning and trying to teach each other on campus. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Me should certainly know when a dog team is looking.
3, 2, 1. Borough researchers say that more than 1 out of 4 workers in Fairbanks is employed by the federal government. Most of them are in the military, But even civilians have ideas about making government work better. Bill Robertson worked for the federal government for 33 years before leaving the Bureau of Land Management to take over as president of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce.
Why do we have to have an agency that does nothing but parks? Why do we have to have an agency that does nothing but wildlife? Do we have so many excess dollars in the bank that we can afford so many kingdoms of single use? I say combine the agencies into one homogeneous group. Think of it, a one-stop shop with all the answers, hopefully, or one database, one set of regulations, and no shuffling from agency to agency.
Robertson spoke along with 15 other people from business and government. Many of them were critical of agencies that developed regulations in Washington and applied them to Alaska. There's the Clean Air Act, which has worked well, but now threatens the borough with drastic and expensive punishments. The Clean Water Act, which the city of North Pole's mayor says requires that managers add pollution to their water in order to clean it up enough to meet arbitrary percentages. The Environmental Protection Agency took a lot of criticism for waste and contradictory regulation, but everything at this hearing was fair game. Newsminer publisher Paul Massey even challenged two congressional rules which allow Senator Stevens to bring jobs and money to Alaska. Massey says Congress should rotate committee chairs to all members without regard to seniority, and it should require bill titles be relevant to their contents.
This change in procedure would require Congress to keep each bill germane to its title. In other words, no amendments or riders that have no relation to the subject would be allowed to be attached to the bill. This would allow individuals, the common citizen, to track legislation much easier. The change would also prevent members of Congress from sliding in special pork projects and controversial projects behind the scenes.
Massey says by distributing power more equally among members of Congress, lobbyist influence will be diluted and Congress members will have to treat agencies and each other more fairly. But for all the criticism, some managed to praise the work of government. Harold Noyes, resource development manager for Doyon Limited, says as the state's largest private landholder, his company finds a receptive audience at places like the BLM, Fish and Wildlife, and the Park Service.
Our experience as a customer in dealing with these agencies is generally positive and constructive. Over the years, through relatively frequent interaction with a number of agencies, we've developed productive working relationships, often with specific individuals, providing for effective solutions to routine matters and an atmosphere conducive to constructive approaches to those matters which are less than routine.
Some 50 people turned out for the hearing, many of them environmentalists who were not invited to testify. They were critical of the proceedings, saying some of the testimony presented was inaccurate and entered the congressional record unchallenged. Stevens' office says the Greens were excluded because their positions weren't relevant to the discussion. The senator plans another hearing in Anchorage Wednesday and a third in Juneau on Thursday. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
It started pretty violently. Emperor Claudius was persecuting the martyrs, and Valentine must have been somewhere in the underground, maybe a priest or a bishop. History's not sure, but it is known that a devout man by that name was dragged before the prefect of Rome, ordered to renounce his faith, and he didn't, and he was beaten, and the poor soul was beheaded on the 14th day of February. So, 1,700 years later, why was I standing at the card counter last night, daisies in one hand and a bag of candy in the other? There were 20 other people there, kids and mothers and kids and fathers, lovers, one kind of scruffy guy in a beard and old Carhartts who seemed a little spooked by the crowd. We were all buying things for someone, and I was thinking about the cynics who say we're all just slaves of commerce at the end of the 20th century. It's got to be more complicated than that. Just like the history is, the medieval Catholics made Valentine a saint and honored him with a feast day at a time when it was popular and romantic to believe that all the birds mated on the 14th of February. And young lovers wrote to each other then. They called on the slain priest's name, and they promised to be each other's Valentine. They wrote sweetly of the birds' romantic rituals. They invoked the ancient Roman fertility festival, the Lupercalia, not so coincidentally, also celebrated this week. If it didn't serve some purpose for us, Americans wouldn't be there either, supporting the florists and the card and chocolate companies and the balloon makers. I think maybe history's giving us a chance to remember the passions, Valentine's passion for his faith and his fellow man, and the birds for each other, and youth for each other and for love and fertility, And innocence, too. A kinder, gentler love. One that's suitable for candy hearts and mushy cards, as useful to classmates as life mates. Valentine's Day is a good day, a good one for sharing lightly, and a good one, if it's in you, for giving with all your heart. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Now, where'd I put my chocolates?
According to a list released by Senator Stevens' office, 12 people are scheduled to testify at Tuesday's hearing. The three area mayors are to speak for local governments, and academia is to be represented by University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor Joan Wadlow, Management Professor David Porter, and retired President William Wood. Industry representatives include battery manufacturer Earl Romans, who says he was run out of business by overreaching environmental regulations. Mary Nordale is to speak on behalf of miners, and newspaper publisher Paul Massey is expected to join Chamber of Commerce Chairman Bart Laban, car dealer Ralph Seekins, and Ron Ricketts of the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation. This list has environmentalists complaining that they're being shut out of the hearing. David Vandenberg of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center says the panel selections are skewed to gain a narrow perspective.
It's very important that we emphasize that we have a voice at this hearing to point out areas where the federal government has not worked, has not coordinated with the state or with the borough or with local jurisdictions to protect people and to protect the environment. We're not going to get to make those points. Instead, you're going to hear where the federal government is failing to provide enough resources for big extractive industries to come in here and make a buck.
Vandenberg spoke along with several other environmental advocates, including a bed and breakfast owner and a wilderness guide. They were joined by Betty Rollins, a local activist who lives near Fort Wainwright. She and dozens of her neighbors found out last year that their drinking water is polluted with solvents, information that governmental regulators failed to pass on for years.
I've got major problems with government that not only doesn't work properly, but hides things when they do find out about things.
Rollins says the panel lacks representation from people and organizations that represent broader interests of citizens in general. Mitch Rose, spokesman for Senator Stevens, says the environmental organizations weren't invited because officials didn't believe they fit into the purpose of the senator's field hearings. They're designed to discuss governmental regulations, restructuring, and resource management. That said, Rose says anyone's welcome to file written testimony. Stevens is chair of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. After Fairbanks, he plans hearings Wednesday in Anchorage and Thursday in Juneau. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
American composer... Why are you doing this to me? 3, 2, 1. American composer Joseph Schwantner selected from over a decade of Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches to build his musical tribute. New Morning for the World, which opens with a crash of drums and a brass fanfare, is a musical setting for King's message. It will be performed by the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra this Sunday, narrated by KTVF's Curtis Thomas. The Schwantner closes Sunday's performance. Another voiced work honors Abraham Lincoln. The Lincoln Portrait by Aaron Copland will be narrated by UAF Professor Emeritus Lee Salisbury. Also on the program, three of Fairbanks' finest young musicians, each a 1996 concerto competition winner. Cellist Christopher Hopkins, who is 10, will play a work by Ludwig Mendelssohn. Cellist James Sosiewski, who's 14, a work by Edward Lalo. And violinist Melissa Spencer, 16 years old, a piece by Fritz Kreisler. The concerto winners will also perform in a special children's concert Saturday afternoon at 3 in the Charles Davis Concert Hall on campus. Sunday's symphony performance, also at the Davis, begins at 4 o'clock. The symphony will open with Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. In the last 18 months, Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Services has invested more than $1 million in South Fairbanks, helping renters there make their homes their own and helping owners make repairs. The nonprofit hopes to establish nearly 100 new owners by the year 2000, mostly among low-income and minority residents. About half the homes in Fairbanks are owner-occupied, but disproportionately few are owned by people of color. Housing Services wants to help change the ratio, especially in South Fairbanks, where absentee ownership is high. Loan Program Coordinator Denise Daniello says when the resident is the owner, both the people and the neighborhood benefit.
It is our belief that people who live in the homes that they own are much more apt to invest back in the properties, keep them up, make the repairs that are needed, and also to feel connected to the neighborhood. And in this way, neighborhood stability can be achieved because the transition rate is much lower.
Daniello says people who come to Housing Services for help usually can't meet a standard mortgage and might have trouble with the down and closing. Grant monies help underwrite those costs, and a combination of first and second mortgages bring down monthly payments. The first mortgage is conventional, brought in through any one of several cooperating banks and secondary market investors like Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. The second is financed by Housing Services through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It brings in a lower interest rate, Daniello says, effectively subsidizing the first and lowering monthly expenses for the borrower.
With our second mortgage money, we're able to structure a loan repayment with terms and an interest rate that fits the borrower's income, existing income, and their current debt load.
This winter, Housing Services launched an Alaska Native homeownership drive in a partnership effort with First National Bank of Anchorage and Fairbanks Native Association. The project will include down payment grants, loan information in both Athabascan and English, and Housing Services one-on-one counseling to help people understand the steps between wanting a house to securing a loan.
The people we see are first-time homebuyers and don't know anything at all about how to go about getting financing. Obtaining financing can be pretty complex. So we try to work very closely with our customers and explaining the process, helping them to fill out the applications and so forth.
Neighborhood Housing also holds group education sessions and periodic seminars. The next one is called Banks, Bathrooms, and Bills, All You Need to Know About Owning a Home. It'll be held in April. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. If one in every three or four college students had an illness that was debilitating enough to cause serious problems, you'd think we'd hear quite a bit about it. But when the problems students are having are academic, social, and personal, and when the source seems to be alcohol, it's hard to diagnose and hard to cure what's going on. One in three UAF students says that alcohol or other drugs gets them in some sort of trouble. They point to the kinds of public misconduct that breaks laws or results in problems for others, like drinking and driving, fighting, vandalizing buildings, or taking sexual advantage of someone else. One in four students say they've experienced what they call serious personal consequences connected to substance use. They've tried to stop drinking but haven't been able to, or they've done poorly on tests or projects because of their drinking. Some report being hurt or injured while under the influence, and about 4% say they've thought seriously of suicide. Each year, roughly 10% of UAF students say someone has taken advantage of them sexually because of substances. Chandra Stone, who is a student assistant with UAF's Drug and Alcohol Prevention Program, says communication and decision-making skills suffer badly when alcohol mixes with a dating situation.
I think with alcohol, people sometimes use it to break down barriers so they can be a little more uninhibited, but I think that's could be a very bad thing. And that's for both parties. You know, a man or a woman may not realize they're pressuring somebody, and a man or a woman may not realize that they're being pressured because of the influence of alcohol.
Some of the student problems may be a combination of youth and substances. Two out of three students who are underage say they drink, about the same number as older students. But the younger students may not know their limits. Sophomore biology major Laura Kim Alexander says she experimented with alcohol in her teens, but pulled away when she saw her friends getting drunk all the time. She says she was surprised and disturbed to find the same thing going on at UAF.
I'm not saying drinking is necessarily a bad thing, but drinking to excess, drinking every day, being drunk every day is a really serious matter, you know. And I think a lot of people here are alcoholics and they don't understand that. And that is very, very dangerous, not only for assault, you know, whether sexual or anything, that people just start fights for no reason.
For Eric Gervin, now a resident assistant at Nerland Hall, a change of dormitory has made a big difference. At Lathrop Hall last year, he says, at least one or two rooms were up drinking at night every night.
On weekends, you multiply that by a floor or so. And drugs were, are present, I'm definitely sure. I guess I can compare it because this year I live in Nerland, which is alcohol, tobacco-free, substance-free hall. Where it does exist, it exists a lot more quietly because it's not supposed to be there at all.
About 1,000 students live on campus. Those who do can choose from just 3 substance-free dorm options, 2 floors of Bartlett Hall on upper campus and Nerland. UAF is not unique. Colleges and universities everywhere are at risk for problems associated with substances. Still, some of the things students are encountering here, unwanted sexual interactions, problems in school and with peers, and struggles in their own lives, seem to be directly related to alcohol and might be significantly reduced without it. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
During the next 3 days, scores of Native high school students are attending workshops that Jeannie Nelson says are designed to help them prepare for successful futures. Nelson, the Alaska Native Education Coordinator at the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, says this conference aims to encourage young people to become the next generation of leaders.
Our future relies on our youth. Our youth are the traditional culture bearers and future leaders, and we want to get right in there and help them to develop skills and leadership abilities, formulate ideas on what they want to do in their lives, have positive, successful experiences through the academic as well as the social world.
The 3-day conference will feature speakers from across Alaska as well as panel discussions on issues ranging from beating depression to clarifying the roles of young men. The students will also get a chance to visit with local elders and explore career options with various businesses. Nelson says the conference will also show students successful role models and build camaraderie to let them know they're not alone.
I think that every person, Alaska Native or from any kind of culture, life is a struggle at this point, with the different things that we deal with. For Alaska Native youth, there are a lot of many times issues are looked at in the negative, and there's a beautiful culture out there that needs to be sustained and needs to be carried forth to the future. And these are the kids that are recognizing that this needs to happen, and it's going to have to come from within them.
It's serious business, but Nelson adds the conference is meant to be entertaining as well. In addition to dances and gatherings, they'll hear from actress Kimberly Norris and actor Brian Frejo, both of whom played parts in the movie Geronimo. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Randy Baton, Mark Nero, and John Slage were buried by a slide they may themselves have triggered as they ascended an ice wall on Kastner Glacier, an area that has been recently extremely ripe for an avalanche. Avalanches are most common when heavy snowfall is followed by high winds, just the conditions experienced in the interior over the past 2 weekends. The winds pack the snow so much that when it's triggered, it falls in massive chunks. Dog handler Kathy Harms works with PAWS search and rescue dogs. She says an avalanche is an extremely powerful natural force.
Once that snow tumbles down a hill and hits the bottom and stops, it's extremely dense. It's more like sludge and concrete than it is like light and fluffy snow. Many people who have worked at trying to locate people under avalanches say it's like probing through gravel. It can be so dense.
Harm says if a person is trapped in snow that dense, they may be completely unable to move and perhaps even unable to breathe. Although people have been known to survive avalanches up to 5 days, the chances worsen with time. PAWS sent dogs and handlers to Kastner Glacier to assist in the search. Avalanche experts from Fort Greeley and Anchorage, state troopers, helicopter teams, and the Fairbanks Mountaineers began looking for the men early Monday morning. They located them yesterday. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
John Schandelmeyer is taking a long-needed rest after spending 12 and a half days on the trail. Schandelmeyer of Paxson arrived into Whitehorse at 6:47 Yukon time this morning to win the 1996 Yukon Quest, crossing the finish line with 11 dogs in harness. Schandelmeyer followed Rick Mackey of Nanana out of the final dog drop at Braeburn yesterday afternoon, but caught and passed him by the time they reached Tokini Hot Springs, 23 miles from Whitehorse. Chandlemyer says he felt confident that he could win the race after watching how well his dogs continued to run even after over 800 miles on the trail.
I actually had a pretty good clue of it when Rick and I were traveling together because I had run and the dogs would still run. And very seldom will dogs run at this stage of a race, a long race, but they would run. And you didn't have to say much either. You could just get them, you know, just ask them to go, and they would get up, and they would all run, not just one dog. They would all jump and run, you know, in the harness, and, you know, not like a sprint team, but still 15 to 16 miles an hour, which is a pretty good run for a quest team.
Chandlemyer says that extra rest and care for his team kept him strong all the way to the finish line and was crucial to his winning the race.
The key is probably is taking care of your dogs to make sure you have dogs at the end so you can do what we did this last day. And not just me, I mean Rick in particular, but also probably Bill Stewart, able to drive your dogs the last 24 hours basically without hardly any breaks. I mean, we came the last 200 miles on a 4-hour rest stop and a 2-hour rest stop, which you don't usually do even in a 200-mile race with fresh dogs, you know, so there, you know, you have to have dogs that in very good condition on that last day to do that.
Chandlemyer will receive $25,000 in prize money and a donated gold and diamond encrusted belt buckle worth an estimated $60,000 for his efforts. Rick Mackey was the second musher into Whitehorse, arriving at 7:45 this morning, driving 9 dogs. Other mushers expected to finish the race today include Bill Stewart of Whitehorse, Fairbanks musher Mark May, 1995 Yukon Quest winner Frank Turner, Toke dog driver Peter Bukeri, and Fairbanks and Patty Santucci. In Whitehorse, I'm Roger Leff.
The first soloist to risk his life attempting the summit for the 96th season is on his way, and more right behind him. Gentle, soft-spoken, well-versed Frenchman Gerard Perrault says his journey is a personal one. He declined to talk on tape, but says the climb is a bonding with nature. The extremes, he says, can be wonderful, though unforgiving. Only two men, Dave Staley and Vern Tejas, both Alaskans, have summited Denali in the winter and returned alive. Roger Robinson says it's uncommon to have so many people attempting this climb.
We've seen a trend in the past 10 years of one or maybe two people soloing or trying to do solo climbs in the winter. And this year, all of a sudden, we have 4 people. 3 of the 4 have been here before attempting solo climbs. And so the majority of them, we hope, know what they're getting into. We do not encourage solo climbing. It's very dangerous.
Robinson says soloists must register with the National Park Service and complete a form giving details of their climb and colors of their clothing and gear. National Park Service cannot prevent anyone from climbing the mountain, but Robinson says rangers give every soloist a clear understanding of the risks involved.
We'll see 40 below temperatures during the normal climbing season in, say, May, early May, but these people could find it as cold as 60 or even 70 below, and that's not counting any kind of wind chill. And we often have very strong winds up high on the mountain, and winds so strong that they have literally, they'd probably blow someone off the top. People like Naomi Uramura never could find his body, and 3 other very famous Japanese climbers were, as far as we could tell, were flash frozen up near the high camp.
26-year-old Canadian Derek Stanberry takes off for the mountain soon. He has summited Denali twice, climbed Mount Logan alone, and soloed a crossing of the Great Slave Lake. Alaskan Todd Deese will attempt a winter ascent in the next few weeks. With help from Greg Schweitzer, I'm Kathy Sullivan in Talkeetna.
Following gains made in reducing drunk driving among adults, lawmakers in 1994 wanted to bring the same message to young drinkers. Under law, people between 14 and 21 automatically lose their license for 3 months if they're found drinking or drugging, even if they're nowhere near a car when they were caught. A second offense and the license is revoked for a full year. In 1995, almost 2,800 young people lost their licenses. One of them, West Valley High School senior Danny Harrison, was caught after he and some friends had passed a bottle before a school dance. While not driving presents one problem, he says he soon found other consequences.
The financial aspect of this law is ridiculous. It's going to be costing me a whole lot of money to pay insurance. We've had to pay for a lot of fines. We've had to pay for an alcohol education class, that sort of thing. And I think we're going to have to pay for a $100 evaluation before I'm even eligible to get my license back. And then there's a $100 reinstatement fee for my license.
Aside from roughly $500 in fees, once Harrison's insurance company found out, it threatened to drop the family policy and only continued coverage when the family dropped Danny from their policy. Now, where he was once paying less than $700 a year, the best quote he's received is $2,800 a year. His mother, Ann Harrison, says while she supports efforts to curb alcohol use among teens, the money involved is making for some difficult choices.
One of the rates that I got over a three-year period would be close to $15,000, which Danny would be riding his bike before we'd be paying that kind of money, because that money definitely needs to be going towards university education and not paying high-risk insurances.
When his license was revoked, Danny held on to his part-time dishwashing job. He now hitchhikes to work or gets a ride from his folks. Ann says she agrees her son made a bad choice, but she's not sure the law is a deterrent.
We're very hypocritical about the ways we look at alcohol. We glorify it, we advertise it, and then we tell our youth, you can't do that. And if you do, you're going to have your license revoked. And then as we are experiencing as a family, there's consequences way beyond the suspension of the license for 3 months for the first offense.
In Alaska, 3 out of 4 students admit to trying alcohol before their 18th birthday. Kate Kustra, who also lost her license, says when so many people are breaking the law, maybe it's the law that needs repair.
It seems to me that it should be accepted as it's going to happen, and maybe the law should be made to make it more safe instead of trying to crush it like this, which is obviously not working.
Kustra says among her friends, the law has made drinking more secretive, though for her, the law has worked, at least in part. While she may still have an occasional glass of wine when it's offered as part of dinner, she doesn't drink with friends because she says it's too much of a hassle arranging rides. She doesn't want to betray her parents' trust again. Kate's mother, Carolyn Peck, says while getting busted has helped her daughter mature, she's concerned that the harsh penalties will drive another wedge between experimenting teens and the adults they're modeling.
In a way, I think I want my children and my friends of my children to learn how to drink responsibly. And so rather than just say no, never, yes, sometimes, and in moderation, not when you're doing sports. I mean, to realize the toll it takes on your body. So I guess this law seems overly repressive and punitive.
Peck says after seeing what happened to Danny's insurance rates, she's taken a don't ask, don't tell approach toward her insurance company. But that, she says, tells Kate that sometimes honesty is not the best policy, at least when dealing with large institutions like governments and corporations. But no matter, say insurers, they'll find out anyway, as many routinely review the records of young drivers. Officials with the State Division of Motor Vehicles say they'll need to wait at least until next year to see if arrests drop. But UAF Police Sergeant Terry Vrabeck says the Get Tough policy has gotten the attention of teens.
You know, there's been cases in the past where maybe someone gets in trouble for something, and I'm not saying it doesn't get taken care of, but maybe they feel that, well, hey, I can still do that. I'm not going to get in any trouble. In this case, regardless of how minor an incident may be, the revocation is still going to take place. So there is a bite to that, and I think that will get their attention.
Vrabeck says on campus, workshops and education efforts are making the point that lawmakers are serious about reducing teen drinking. But parents like Carolyn Peck wonder whether such penalties, applied without regard to circumstances, don't end up causing more problems than they solve. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
According to McGrath Mayor Glenn Hanway, the governor's matching grant program pretty much assures all communities some dollars each year for projects, but how much is still unsure. Hanway says the legislature hasn't made a final decision on how they'll fund the program. Whatever the amount, he says the cleanup of a 1992 5,000-gallon fuel oil spill at the city water plant will absorb the money.
And we got to remove minimum of 2,500 cubic yards of contaminated material and replace it with clean material and move the tank and get a new liner and build a new dike. It'll easily go over budget.
Mayor Hanway says $30,000 to $40,000 from two other grants are also targeted at the spill, which resulted after city workers failed to pump a storage tank free of water before filling it. A tank valve later froze and broke, causing the 92 spill. Hanway has prepared a plan of attack for cleaning up the tainted area. It's now awaiting approval by the Department of Environmental Conservation. He says after approval, he'll be able to develop a cost estimate for the project. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
This Festival of Native Arts is the 23rd annual gathering of Native performers and artists in Fairbanks. The 3 days of singing, dance, art, and crafts is always a student-run event at the university, and this year over 100 volunteers pulled together to make it happen. Even as they were burning the midnight oil, Festival Coordinator Carlin Ichoak says he was thinking how much harder the performers and artists were working to make the festival happen.
It's not easy to have a job or go to school and to learn the traditions of your ancestors or of your relatives, and to be able to learn them well enough to perform them in front of other people or to show them to other people. So the idea that of learning singing and dancing and your language and how to carve, there's more to it than just putting it on a shelf or bringing it on a stage. It's not something you do over the weekend or every now and then. It's a lifelong educational process.
Ichoak says the visiting performers started getting ready for this weekend over 6 months ago, carving and sewing to prepare for art and craft sales, training for songs and dances, making cuspucks, and raising money to get to Fairbanks.
Just the groups that have come in, they've spent an awful amount of money and exhausted an awful lot of time getting here. I see a lot of them are tired, but the energy and the flavor of the festival has rejuvenated their spirits.
Ichoak grew up learning Inupiaq-style dancing in Barrow, and when he lived in Nome, danced with the Siberian Yupik group from Gambell. Somewhere along the line in his teens, he says he got embarrassed about dancing and stopped. But as the festival opened Thursday night, Ichoak was among the dancers. He's joined an Inupiaq group on campus, learning the songs of both cultures.
And it's really great. It's really bringing back the spirit of our villages and where a lot of us come from. And it's bringing it right here on campus and allowing us to find that balance between Western culture, Western education, and what we left back at home.
At the Festival of Native Arts in Fairbanks with the Nunimut dancers from Anaktuvik Pass, I'm Susan McInnes. A door opened for Matanuskamade when Carr Gottstein opened a store in Juneau. The new Southeast Alaska market will be carrying the Alaska dairy product. A long-term relationship between the two companies helped, but the real key to getting to Juneau, says Matmade's president, Joe Van Treek, was being able to move product from one place to another.
We've made a number of attempts in the last 10 years to figure out how we could get to Juneau and be, you know, price competitive in the marketplace there. And transportation costs always were a barrier to that.
The answer, Van Treek says, was Carr's trucks traveling regularly between the two cities. For the milk products company, it's a marker, the first time in its 60-year history that products carrying its name will be sold in the capital city. Matanuskamade isn't the only Alaskan-grown or processed product gaining ground in the marketplace. Alaskans also grow small grains, livestock, vegetables, and potatoes. Alaska's vegetables are showing up more and more in the markets, and potatoes, partly because of their long storage and shelf life, are the real leaders. Potatoes ring up over half Alaska's commodities revenue, and they lead the way in both in-state and export sales. As an industry watcher since the mid-70s, University of Alaska Fairbanks Resources Management Professor Carol Lewis says more Alaskan products on grocer shelves and signs that say Alaskan grown in the markets reflect a growing consumer trust.
When you ask consumers now, do you look for Alaska grown, they'll answer yes enthusiastically because they're responding to the good quality. 15 to 20 years ago, you could have asked that same question and they would have said, most likely, and I have seen surveys where this has been said, We look for them to avoid them because of the poor quality.
Matt Maids Van Treek says if people and markets are becoming more receptive, the producer has to bear the responsibility.
Just because I'm here making a widget and you have a store and you sell widgets, if I'm not producing something that's of a caliber that you want your customers to see, it's not fair for me to beat on your door and cry, you know, buy Alaska if I don't have a quality product that's worth selling.
Van Treek says the producer also has to make those great widgets, whether they're carrots, potatoes, or milk, available consistently. And markets and growers like Kars and Matanuska Made are cooperating to make that happen.
The farmers, both in the greater Anchorage area, Palmer of the Matanuska Valley, and the farmers that are up in the Fairbanks area, have seen the areas where the retailers will work with them on products that can be inventoried for longer times.
Thus the success of potatoes, which can be filtered onto the shelves as needed, and of carrots, lettuce, and other vegetables, which are showing up earlier in Alaska's grocery stores and lasting longer through the summer growing season. And for Matt Maids Van Treek, who has finally found a way to get to Juneau. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Julius Caesar invented leap year as part of his Julian calendar in 45 BC. Caesar's astronomer, Sosigenes, developed the calendar based on the fact that it takes the Earth 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 46 seconds to revolve around the Sun. They called it close at 365 and a quarter days, and a calendar year was defined as 365 days, with one leap day added every 4 years to compensate for the lost quarter day. But a problem crept in. 700 years later, the monk Venerable Bede pointed out that the 365 and a quarter day Julian calendar was 11 minutes too long. But since the error added up so slowly, no one did anything about it. Fast forward another 800 years, when Pope Gregory XII stepped in. By then, spring equinox, when days and nights are of equal length, fell upon March 11th, not the 21st. The Pope's solution? He simply erased 10 days. October 5th was now October 15th. And to eliminate the problem, Pope Gregory said that if a millennial year is evenly divisible by 400, it's a leap year. The Pope's modification knocked out leap years in 1800 and 1900, but in 2000 we'll have another one, because it evenly divides by 400. The Gregorian calendar, as it's now known, hangs on most of our walls, but it wasn't so popular when it was first developed. While most Roman Catholic countries adopted it at once, Protestant countries didn't make the change for years. England resisted the switch until 1752. And Russia didn't accept the Gregorian calendar until 1918. So when the U.S. purchased Alaska in 1867, residents here lost 11 days in the transition. Another Alaskan note. Since we have an extra day this year, summer solstice, when the Earth tilts Alaska nearest the sun, happens on June 20th. A day earlier than the usual June 21st. From the Geophysical Institute, this is Ned Rozelle.
I remember standing with Will Peterson on the riverbank in McGrath overlooking all these dog teams. It was a moonless night and they were about 200 yards away. All we could see were these headlamps moving around in this chaotic little dance like stars let loose in the sky. Then we noticed our shadows stretched all the way across the river. We were about a quarter mile tall, and here I am waving my arms and high-stepping, watching my shadow across the river. I did this for what seemed like several minutes until finally Will and I both realized where the light from our shadows was coming from. It was a guy on a snow machine about 20 feet behind us, just waiting there patiently for the dance to quit. He must have thought we were a couple of wackos. Will Peterson and I were kind of punchy by the time we arrived into Caltag. We were staying in the Head Start building, working among all this little tiny furniture built for small kids. It was like we were stars in the Land of Giants movie. Anyway, we decided to have some fun and we called the show's producer Maureen Clark to feed stories, and we made these references that we had to call from this little phone booth that was really small. After we finished, we took this pint-sized phone booth outside and put a tiny chair in it and pretended to make calls on this plastic phone. We took pictures, and I remember one, Will was stuffed into this little booth, sitting on this little chair, his head kind of pushed into the ceiling, elbows out the windows, and these long legs stretched out into the street. He looked like he was about 12 feet tall. We finally gave Maureen the pictures and clued her into what we were talking about that day. She didn't think it was that funny, but it made me laugh. I received the warmest welcome in Unalakleet. We got into town about an hour before the sun started to set, and it was low and the light was just beautiful. We made our way downtown and were greeted by a whole sea of smiling people. All these kids and adults out from school and work, and they were all just so glad to see these strangers in town, and there were so many smiles and so much excitement that I was just infected by the whole spirit. And it didn't matter that they didn't know me or that I hadn't had a shower for close to a week. People were just glad to see us. It was a great feeling.
Three, two, one. They say everybody has a story to tell, and a lot of people are working on the writer's craft these days. Writer's workshops never lack for a crowd at colleges and universities. Every town has at least one group of writers who share their work and help each other edit and consider what they've written. And there are always men and women up late at night searching for just the right words to match their thoughts. Seattle poet Christiane Balk has been thinking about craft and culture. She says the number of people turning to words may well be functioning as a kind of antidote or at least a reaction to the changes mass media have brought to America.
You know, we have a mass culture that's dominated by visual arts right now. Visual arts meaning the video and the movie and the television. And so there's been sort of a mass transition away from the word towards these moving pictures and the stimulation and the distraction that they offer us.
Balk admits stimulation and distraction can often be delightful, and visual pop culture has brought us some wonderful stories. She's concerned, though, that people not forget to exercise their own voices, to write and speak and listen to each other.
So for those of us who for whom words are very important, and I think there's a lot of people that are very connected to words, it's hard to find a place in our society to be listened to. You know, I think people used to sit around and talk with each other a lot more than they do now. We live in a very fragmented society. Many of us live very fragmented lives.
Writers in this town and others around the nation may be picking up the fragments. Balk says writing is one way to find wholeness when society feels in pieces. And sharing one's work also does something to bring people together as they concentrate on what the words have to say. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.